This is Read On Air with Red Zell. For those passionate about books.
Hello, welcome to Read On Air, the show all about reading that belongs to you. I'm your host, Red Zell, and this week, following the announcement of the shortlist for the 2017 Carnegie Medal, we'll try to judge what turns a good book into a prize winner. Joanne Harris gives us a view from both sides of the fence, revealing what she looks for as a judge and how it feels to be a winner.
It's not always easy to know exactly what that ingredient is. Sometimes it's just a feeling that it gives you.
Tanya Landman tells Robert what it felt like to win the 2015 Carnegie Medal.
Actually winning it was just kind of beyond belief, really. I still don't think it sunk in. I still kind of keep waking up thinking, oh, God, I don't believe it.
We discover more about the award the RNIB Library has been shortlisted for.
It's a huge deal because these awards are the most prestigious in the book calendar.
And I branch into young adult fiction to find out whether the Lie Tree deserves all the hype. That's all coming up in today's show. Author Joanne Harris is no stranger to the world of literary prizes. She's been a judge for various prestigious awards, including the Whitbread, the Orange, and most recently, this year's RNIB Creative Writing Competition. She's also won a string of British and international awards, not just for her fiction, but also for her cookery books. So who better to ask about the essential ingredients that go into a piece of prize-winning writing? But first, here's a clip from her multi-award-winning novel, Chocolat.
March wind's an ill wind, my mother used to say. But in spite of that, it feels good, smelling of sap and ozone and the salt of the distant sea. A good month, March, with February blowing out of the back door and spring waiting at the front. A good month for change.
Welcome again to Read On Air, Joanne.
Hi, I'm really glad to be here. Thank you.
So what do you think the ingredients that go into making up a prize-winning book are?
I think it depends very much on the prize. But I think it has to be a book that people can connect with on some level or on more than one level. I tend to look for a level of human connection, as well as it's nice to have good writing. It's nice for it to be enjoyable also. But I think we need to feel that the author has something to convey that we can share.
So that also implies that for different genres, or maybe in this case for short stories as opposed to novels, there are different criteria that you would judge the writing on?
Yes, I tend to look at style because I like style and because I respond to the sound of words read aloud. And I think that the delivery system is obviously important. And I look at the characters too. I like to feel that the characters are believable and human, and that you care about them. Even if you don't necessarily like them, I think understanding them is very important. And there is a level of structure in a short story which is very important, because short stories are very hard to write, difficult to structure, and you have to feel that they're leading you somewhere and that it's not a disappointment when you get there.
I know you yourself have written two volumes of short stories and 18 novels. Does that argue that perhaps short story writing is a more difficult discipline?
I think it's much more difficult. I think it's a deceptive discipline because many people feel slightly daunted by the idea of writing something long. And they assume that if they start with short stories, then they will be able to work themselves up to writing a novel. I think actually the short story is a much more difficult discipline to crack. You have to be absolutely spot on in terms of structure, because otherwise the short story just won't work. And it's always much harder to do things in miniature. You can get away with a lot of things with a long piece. With a novel, you can get away with slight bagginess in the subplots or ramblings. You can't do that with a short story. It shows if there's anything wrong with it at all. If it doesn't hang just right, then it will show and the story will fail.
Are you working on a new collection of short stories, or is it one of those things that when an idea comes that you feel would work better as a short story, you work quietly on it in the... I assume you have some quiet time between your longer fiction?
But, Not so much quiet time, but I do. I can tell the difference between an idea which is going to be a short story and something that's going to be a novel or part of a novel. I don't write many short stories. I might write 3 or 4 a year. So I just basically write them as and when I get the ideas, and then I will put them into a collection later on.
And coming back to judging the RNIB writing competition, which obviously was for short stories of under 1,000 words, with this year's theme was anniversaries. We can't reveal the winner yet, but you and I both sat on the judging panel, and I know that you read the entries and I listened to them, and that led to quite an interesting debate about form and structure. I know that something that I thought came across very well as snappy dialogue, you said jarred visually on the page. Have you ever sat on a panel of judges before where people have listened to audio versions rather than read the book?
No, I haven't. It's the first time that's happened. But I am aware that there is a slight difference in the delivery system. I think it's important that things work read aloud. Usually I like to read aloud. I like audiobooks. I like to listen to what's on the page, because I think that's what it's for. But no, it's really the first time that I've encountered that distinction, and it's a very interesting one.
Do you think there may be room for listeners rather than readers to sit on panels in the future, seeing as so many books are now being published simultaneously as audiobooks and in print?
I think that would be very interesting. I think it would be a very good idea, and it would be very interesting in terms of the discussion that people would have, because obviously not everybody feels that it's important to listen to the words, but I think it's such a large element of it. And audiobooks, of course, are becoming much more popular than they were. It's much easier now to get full-length audiobooks. And I think it's an area that people are going to be much more aware of and much more interested in future.
I suppose the whole genesis of storytelling was as an oral tradition in the first place, so maybe it's just come full circle.
Yes, I think so. Of course, I think telling stories and reading stories and having stories read are all slightly different parts of the storytelling experience. But yes, I think it's important that we look at all of those parts.
And do you think authors make the best judges of literary competitions?
Not necessarily, but I think authors have certain insight on how things are written. I think inevitably, if you write books, you tend to look more critically at the way things are structured, edited, the way words are used. I think authors tend to be aware of those things that perhaps casual readers are not aware of. But there are so many different ways of processing a book. You don't always necessarily do it from a technical point of view or a professional point of view. So I think it's important to have a wide variety of people on a panel.
I thought it was very interesting that of the three judges who sat on the panel for the final of the RNIB competition, we all identified the same group of standout stories, even if each of us had a slightly different favourite, which led to a good debate. Is that usually the case when you've been judging?
I think most of the time it is. It does depend where people are coming from, what their discipline is, what they are looking for, and what their idea of a prize-winning story is. Sometimes when there's a prize with a particular character, like, for instance, the Baileys, you can get some quite acrimonious discussion about whether something would be a good result for the prize. And the same is true of the Booker. But I think most of the time we gravitate to the stories that we can connect with. And so very often people are surprised to find that the top winning entries have sort of all been identified independently by different people.
It is funny. It's rare that I've ever picked up a book that has won a prize where I haven't found that elusive charm that I think good storytelling always has. It's a secret ingredient, but you know it when you find it, don't you?
I think you do. And it's not always easy to know exactly what that ingredient is. Sometimes it's just a feeling that it gives you. Sometimes it's something that it has articulated that you've never heard articulated in that way before. Sometimes it's just the fact that the prose sings.
That's a lovely way of putting it. So I have to ask you, what's it like being shortlisted for a prize and then to win it?
Do you know what? I haven't actually won all that many prizes. I've won a number of international ones, but I've been shortlisted many times for British ones and then not quite made it. I just won actually a Fragrance Foundation Award for perfume journalism, and it was a thrilling, thrilling experience. I wasn't aware that I was even eligible, and so I went to this awards ceremony thinking, I'm not going to win this, I'm not even a journalist. And when I did win and got up onto the stage, it was the most wonderful thing.
Oh, how lovely. And when you are shortlisted, when you've won the prizes that you have, do you find that that puts a greater burden of expectation on your next work?
No, I don't think in those terms. I think that sometimes the awarding of prizes is a slightly arbitrary process. I am not entirely certain what people get prizes for. Sometimes they get prizes for a specific book, and sometimes they get prizes because they have been writing great work for a while and people feel that they're ready for a prize. And so it's very nice, but it's not something that I need to keep going, and it's not something that will affect the way I write.
I always remember Terry Pratchett said that the reason he pulled his book out of an awards ceremony was because he felt it would wreck the dinner. it was nice to have been nominated. My thanks to Joanne Harris. Pretty much all of her books are available from the RNIB library, including Shokala, The Gospel of Loki, and my favourite, Gentlemen and Players, which is TB14494.
I guess Ma died, or she was sold, I don't know which. By the time I got around to wondering, there was no one I could ask.
Now in its 80th year, the Silip Carnegie Medal is the UK's oldest prize for children's and young adult fiction. In 2015, it was awarded to Buffalo Soldier by Tanya Landman. She spoke to Robert Kirkwood about the book and the impact of winning the prize.
All I got from her was a name. Charlotte. Darn fool fancy thing for a slave girl. Didn't no one never call me that.
The book concerns a young woman called Charlotte O'Hara. She's a slave in the American Deep South. During the Civil War, she's actually freed along with all the other slaves. But when they were freed, they discovered that, you know, there was really nothing for them. There were no jobs. The whole of the South had been turned upside down during the course of the war. And actually, a lot of the men ended up signing up for the army. So actually, Charlotte O'Hara in this book finds she's in such a desperate situation that she actually disguises herself as a man and signs up for the US Army. But then she discovers that she thinks it's going to be peace. But actually, she is then sent out into the American West to fight in what the Americans called the Indian Wars. So, and it's actually based on a true story. I found when I was researching for a different book, I came across a reference to a real woman who was called Kathy Williams, who had been in exactly that situation. She was a slave. She was freed in the war and had then disguised herself. And she'd actually got away with it for 2-3 years. So it is all actually inspired by a true story.
Now, the other novel you mentioned there is obviously Apache. Is this sort of on the flip side of Apache?
It's kind of linked to it. I mean, Apache, I wanted to write from the point of view of the Native Americans, because when I was growing up, I always watched Westerns, but they were always told from the kind of cowboys and the settlers' point of view. And it was when I was doing the research for Apache that I came across references to the Buffalo Soldiers. So it very much kind of grew out of that. But it was like the Buffalo Soldiers were the sort of missing piece of the puzzle, if you like, that I kind of had on one side the Native Americans and on the other side the white settlers who were moving into the American West. And I didn't realize until I was researching Apache that there was this kind of third group of people who were out there, and that was the guys who had been slaves. And it's a massive chunk of American history that was kind of missing from my knowledge of it, because it doesn't really get very much talked about. So that was why I ended up writing the book.
And what influence does Pocahontas have?
Oh, Pocahontas. Well, I grew up in Gravesend in Kent, which is just kind of downriver from London. And that's actually, you know, that Gravesend hasn't got many claims to fame. But one of its claims to fame is that it's where the real Pocahontas died and was buried. She was actually going back to America, I believe, but she became ill with a fever and then died in Gravesend. And I don't think they know exactly where she was buried, but there is a statue to her. And when I was growing up as a child, that statue was just kind of standing there, and it was she was just kind of outlined against this great grey expanse of Thames. I mean, I think they've built a shopping centre behind her now, but when I was growing up, it was just this beautiful statue of this Native American girl just sort of standing there with her hands outstretched. And she looked so out of place against, you know, this massive expanse of the Thames and then Tilbury Docks in the far distance. And that image really haunted me when I was a child. It really kind of got deep into my subconscious, I think. So, yeah, Pocahontas was probably the start of all of that. And again, you know, it was that image, that very sad image of the girl, was so at odds with the kind of Westerns that I grew up with, where, you know, the Native Americans were always depicted as being these kind of savage warriors. Mm. And so I think that's probably why it jarred in my head.
Well, the Disney version of that story is quite anodyne. Did you feel a need to tell a kind of real raw version?
Certainly, I felt when I was doing Apache, I really felt I needed to, you know, tell the other side of the story, actually for me, really, because I'd been brought up believing cowboys were goodies, you know, and the settlers were the goodies and the Native Americans were the baddies. And when I was writing, I was really writing to tell myself the story that I feel I should have been told as a child.
Now, you've obviously done an awful lot of research for these books. Where does the line between historian and novelist lie?
Well, I always say that it's what I'm writing is historical fiction. You know, I am not writing a textbook. So I do a lot of research because I want to have the kind of sounds and the smells and the scenery all kind of embedded in my head. But there does come a point at which you close the books and you step away from it and you need to let your imagination take over. And the most important thing to do is to tell a really gripping story. So, you know, there are at some times, you know, you have a kind of choice between are you going to stick with absolute historical accuracy or are you going to go with the gripping story? And I always go with the gripping story because I'm writing fiction, you know, otherwise I would be writing textbooks.
And that fiction won the Philip Carnegie Medal. How did that feel?
Oh, absolutely amazing. Absolutely amazing. No, I mean, Buffalo Soldier took me kind of 5 years to write on and off. It was a really big, big, big project. And of course, a lot of that time, you're just there on your own, in your room, you know, and being kind of plagued by self-doubt and, you know, all the kind of things that novelists get plagued with. So then when the book's actually out, you know, and then people start reading it and liking it and talking about it, you know, that's amazing. And then when it gets shortlisted for a prize like the Carnegie, that's even more amazing. And then actually winning it was just kind of beyond belief, really. I still don't think it's sunk in. I still kind of keep waking up thinking, oh, God, I don't believe it. And it was just a magic day as well. I mean, it was a really... Yeah, fantastic. I'm getting quite emotional even talking about it, actually. I get a bit Kate Winslet talking about it.
Now, the part of the Carnegie Medal is the shadowing scheme. What's it like reading the comments on the shadowing part of the Carnegie website?
Oh, I absolutely love it. I love the whole shadowing process. You know, it's so nice. I mean, I was doing kind of Skype interviews and school visits and all of that right the way through. And I love the shadowing groups because they are so passionate and so energetic and intelligent and, you know, fantastic buzzy groups to talk to. And I love the shadowing site as well. I mean, I was absolutely kind of addicted to that, reading it. And again, for the same reason, because you've got, you know, even when they don't like the book, you know, and you know, I got a fair few that were sort of negative reviews of it, but it's students that are really engaged with the whole kind of process of reading and discussing and thinking, and that is just you know, incredibly refreshing and wonderful for a writer. So, yeah, I was kind of visiting that site several times a day.
Now, I've heard you say it's hard to read your book out loud because your voice isn't the character's voice.
Yeah, yeah.
How does that feel when an audio version's made?
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult one for me because, you know, obviously when I go out and do school events and sort of, you know, very often people like to have a reading, and it's one that I don't actually read from it apart from the first section, which kind of, you know, isn't necessarily in Charlie's voice. Mm. But, you know, I didn't have any problem with writing it. It's a funny, because I could hear that voice very, very clearly in my head, but obviously I can't sort of mimic it.
My life began in the cookhouse. Seemed I'd just grown there, like a seed from a crack in the floor. Child's heart got to attach itself to something. Mine attached itself to Cookie, winding around her like bindweed on a post. So long as she was there, I could stand tall. When she was gone, I was left sprawling on the ground, helpless, twisting and twining every which way, not knowing how I was ever going to get up on my own two feet.
Now, I believe during the award ceremony, you were presented with a Braille version of the book.
I was, yes. But that was fantastic. I mean, that was such a wonderful moment. And that was really lovely meeting the group as well that had brought those along. I mean, like I say, it was just a really brilliant day all round. It was fantastic.
How important is it that your works are available in Braille and in giant print and audio and accessible to everyone?
Oh, well, I mean, I'm totally about accessibility, you know, it's incredibly important, I think. You know, it's a shame the whole of the long list isn't kind of done as well. You know, I just think all of this stuff needs to be available for everybody all the time. You know, it's why I'm such a huge supporter of libraries as well. You know, you don't want people's access to books to be limited. So I think that's a wonderful, wonderful aspect to it.
Me and Cookie was the property of Mr. Delaney. His plantation was 3 miles outside of town, but it could have been 3,000. Until the war came, I never set one foot off the place. My world was the cookhouse, the attic above it, the bare earth yard around it, the vegetable garden beyond it. That was all. I never got as far as the fields, even. My only aims in life was pleasing Cookie, not getting noticed by the master, and avoiding Jonas Beecher.
Laurel Lefkoe reading the Philip Carnegie Medal winning book, Buffalo Soldier. Available in print wherever books are sold, and from RNIB Library in giant print, braille, and in audio. For more information, head to rnib.org.uk.
My thanks to Tanya and to Robert. As in previous years, you can find all the shortlisted titles for the 2017 Philip Carnegie Medal in the RNIB Library, where, thanks to a long-standing agreement between the organisers and the RNIB, the books are available in Braille, in giant print, and on audio, so that we, alongside the judges, can ponder who the winner should be.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in both Braille and giant print, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
The annual British Book Awards recognise the contribution of all those involved in bringing writing from the author to the reader. For the second year running, the RNIB Library has been shortlisted for the Library of the Year Award. Mark McCree, RNIB's Senior Manager for Libraries and Heritage, shared the team's delight with our producer, Sophia Asif.
The British Book Awards is an event to celebrate the journey from the author's head to the reader's hand, and this year is the second consecutive year that the RNIB Library has been shortlisted. It's in the category of bringing books to readers and is nominated for Library of the Year. Mark McCree, the Senior Manager for Libraries and Heritage, joins me on the line from Peterborough. Hello, Mark, and congratulations on the nomination.
Hello, and thank you.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit about what this means for the RNIB Library?
Well, it's a huge deal because these awards are the most prestigious in the book calendar. We were shortlisted last year, which was a real privilege, but we have repeated the feat this year, which is fantastic news.
Is there anything, do you think, that the RNIB Library is doing differently that's meant that two nominations in a row?
Well, I think the 2015 shortlisting was predicated largely on the fact that we'd made Talking Books free. So it coincided with our 80th anniversary of Talking Books. And really our 2016 submission was around the impact that that has had. We've brought in a lot more customers to the library. Well over 10,000 new members have joined in a year. We've expanded the amount of content that we've got in the library. So it really is a case of a lot of momentum, I think.
So that's a massive increase in the amount of subscribers. So how many members does the RNIB Library currently have?
We now have over 42,000.
Okay, that is quite some number. And of those 42,000, how many books on average do people tend to borrow?
Well, we issue over 1.4 million Talking Books a year and well over 110,000 volumes of Braille and giant print. So we're very busy.
That is certainly some undertaking, and in so many different formats as well. It's not just a question of taking a print copy from a publisher and making it available to someone who's popping in. This is quite an operation, isn't it?
Absolutely. We also loan music in Braille and modified stave notation, giant print. We have our digital download service, RNIB Overdrive. You know, a lot of our customers, well over 11,000, are now accessing us online through our online catalogue, rniblibrary.com, and RNIB Overdrive. So we've seen a massive increase in the number of people who are independently accessing our services, you know, with the use of technology.
Again, a massive sea change in the way that the library operates and how many customers you're able to reach with such a fantastic array of books. How many titles did you say you had?
Well over 25,000 Talking Books, 21,000 Braille, over 6,500 giant print. So yeah.
That is a lot, and growing all the time.
Yeah, growing at a very fast rate of knots. We signed some partnership agreements with HarperCollins and Audible last year that will mean thousands more, especially Talking Books, will be added to the library over the next year or two.
So that kind of relationship that you're starting to build with commercial ventures, is that something that you feel is a real benefit to the customers who use the RNIB Library?
Yes, I mean, last year we increased the amount of stock we added to the library by just under 20% without any increase in expenditure at all through those exciting partnerships and through renegotiating contracts with other publishers. You know, HarperCollins and Audible both give us content for free, which is obviously fantastic and what we would like to happen across the board. But it's true to say that without spending any extra money at all, we're able to, you know, vastly increase the amount of content we can bring to customers. And also the speed of turnaround, simultaneous publications are becoming the norm. When I started at RNIB just over a couple of years ago, we did a handful a year, and now we're doing 10 or so a week, which is just a phenomenal turnaround.
I mean, that even steals a march on a lot of the more traditional libraries who don't necessarily get their copies at the same time as print publications. So actually, it feels that people who are using Talking Books are actually getting their choice of books before even they reach the library down the road from me.
So absolutely. And it allows our customers to engage in real time with the reading experience. You know, we have a really avid set of followers on our Twitter account at RNIB Library and through Facebook. So, you know, we can highlight when a book's been added to the library, and within a few minutes, you know, people can download it or get it the next day as a Daisy CD or on the USB stick, and then they can tweet about it. And, you know, it's far more interactive and experience rather than, you know, having to wait for months or years or you know, never to get your particular title in your particular format.
It is amazing to see things are changing so rapidly. And is that something that you've had a particular focus on for the library?
Yeah, I mean, that really is our key focus, to get, you know, more content to more people more quickly. You know, it's fantastic that we've got so many people using the library, but there are so many more who could benefit from it. And one of the ways in which we can attract people to the library, aside from the offer being completely free to use, is to make sure that our content is the best it can be, and that all of the titles that people would expect us to have, that we have. And also, there's a broader choice. You know, we still do a lot of our own recordings of titles that would never make it into the commercial market. So, you know, that breadth of the collection, as well as the sheer number of titles that we have, is one of our, you know, strongest selling points.
If a customer, if a member of the RNAB library was requesting a book that was a little bit
left field,
niche interest, how quickly are you able to turn around getting those books to your customers?
Well, I mean, if they're in print, you know, it can be a fairly swift turnaround. We do take forward, you know, a great number of customer requests. We have a stock selection team that meets every month. And the first thing we do is review the list of requests that people have given us. And well over 50, nearly 60% of the requests that we get put into production, you know. So we do actively, you know, that's the most important focus we have for that particular team, turning those customer requests around as quickly as we possibly can.
Which must set up a fantastic relationship for customers. If they see that you're reacting, they're more likely to come back to you for their next title.
Absolutely. I think, you know, we need to be responsive to our customers in the way in which we deliver our services, but also in the way that we develop our content. What our customers say means a great deal to us. And, you know, we try to be led by the feedback that we get and the suggestions that they make.
And all of this is obviously led to a second nomination. Do you know anything about the judges and what they're looking for?
The awards are organised by a publication called The Bookseller, which is the kind of national industry publication. And yes, you can have a look on their website to see who else has been nominated, in which category, and who the judges are. You know, and it's difficult to say what they will be focused on, but we will soon find out. The award ceremony is on the 8th of May, so we've not too long to wait. And there are lots of other, you know, important and excellent libraries on the shortlist, mostly from the public library sector. We're the only charitable and accessible library that's on there, which hopefully will count for a lot. But we'll wait and see.
So the competition is a very different proposition, really, isn't it? What's your edge?
Well, I think it is that accessibility. I mean, one of our challenges is the fact that we don't have a public-facing doorstep on the high street. I mean, I would absolutely love blind and partially sighted people to be able to come to the library and to browse the shelves and to be able to sit down in, you know, comfy sofas and read their, you know, favourite book. But, you know, we just don't have that facility, so all of our customer conversations happen over the phone or via email or you know, via our online platforms. So in lots of ways the public library has a bit of a head start on us, and we work in partnership with public libraries across the whole of the UK for that very reason, because they can reach out to customers in a way that we can't. Having said that, you know, in terms of our range of stock, in terms of our understanding of customer needs, you know, I think we can be a lot more focused in what we do and provide, you know, the kind of depth of accessible formats that you would never find on the high street, you would never find in your local library. You know, they do a fantastic job in serving local communities, but in terms of the range of content and the range of formats that we provide to people's, literally to people's doorsteps, you know, it's posted directly to people's homes. You know, I do think that is our unique selling point.
Well, I can't do anything other than wish you absolutely the very best of luck for the 8th of May. Will you be going to the award ceremony?
I hope so, yes. Yeah, polish my tiara.
Good luck for it. I'm sure that it'll be a fantastic night, whatever the outcome.
Thank you.
And really a brilliant achievement, and really helps to raise the profile of the RNIB Library.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely for us about profile raising. I mean, it would be nice to have an award to to put on the bookshelves at the library, but for me, it's getting the message out there about what it is we do and the difference that we can make. And the more people who know about us, hopefully that means the more Blind and Partially Sighted people who will end up using us. That's what it's all about.
Absolutely. Well, Mark, thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure.
Thank you for taking the time to talk to me today.
No, real pleasure. Thank you very much.
Let's hope the judges recognise the exceptional work done by all the team at the RNIB Library. My thanks to Sophia and Mark. And we'll be hearing more from Mark later in the show. On today's show, we're looking at what makes a piece of writing into a prize winner. Poet Emily Berry has recently been appointed editor of the Poetry Review. She's also judging the entries for the poetry section of this year's RNIB Creative Writing Competition. She told Leanne Coyle from Connect magazine what she looks for in a poem.
Hello, I'm Emily Berry. I'm a poet. I've written two books. The first one is called Dear Boy, and my second collection is coming out soon. It's called Stranger Baby. And I guess I write about personal sort of emotions, relationships. Yeah, it's always very hard to describe the type of poetry that I write, I think.
Yeah, and that actually leads me on very well to my first question for you, because having read some of your poetry, it doesn't seem to conform to any conventions. It can be quite, you know, playful at times. How do you think this, or what do you hope this adds to the reader's experience?
Well, to be honest, I probably don't think that much about the reader's experience when I'm writing a poem. I mean, my main initial aim is to kind of please myself, so I'm like the main reader I have in mind, and I guess I like things to be playful. I sort of feel like even the dark stuff of life can be funny, and that can sometimes, it's just an interesting contrast or something with kind of sadness, and yeah, that's just sort of how it comes out. I don't really sort of think about it very much, to be honest.
Mm. Yeah, I've heard other writers talk about that they perhaps, and I wonder what you think about this, good advice to people, aspiring poets and writers, that to not think too much about your audience, to write for yourself, write what you think is good and what you enjoy.
Yeah, I'd say that's really kind of key. Inevitably, as you sort of get published and know that there are some people reading your work, it will be harder and harder to sort of not think about them. But I think if you do find yourself thinking about the audience overly, I mean, unless you're doing something kind of very sort of performance focused or what have you, it can be quite a pressure in a way. And at the end of the day, a kind of poem is like something that you produce kind of quietly on your own generally. And it's about kind of connecting with your like interior. And that's something very sort of quiet and private, at least in my case. So that's how it sort of works for me.
Speaking of a performance of sorts, so you've actually made the decision to voice up some of your poems. You've recorded some of them, and I think Zanzibar, for example, is on SoundCloud at the moment, which is great for, if you think about, our listeners are blind or partially sighted and sometimes don't read Braille, and sometimes it's a bit difficult to use a screen reader to find a poem. The website's got to be accessible, so that's really helpful. But do you think listening to your poem, especially with hearing your voice reading it, do you think people would experience that differently?
Yeah, I mean, I would hope that the audio sort of experience of the poem would be a sort of key aspect of it. I mean, when I'm writing, I'm always reading aloud as I go along. So for me, it's, you know, although it lives on a page, it's something that I suppose kind of also lives in like sound and music, or like the music of the kind of rhythm of the voice. So, yeah, in principle, I feel like, you know, just listening to the poem and not reading it on the page is a totally full experience of the poem. I mean, I guess the one thing is you don't know the kind of shape of it on the page, but equally when you're reading the poem and not listening to it, you don't know the kind of the way it sounds. So it's just like slightly different experiences that are both equally valid, I think. So,
and you're judging the RNIB writing competition this year. So what are you, would you be looking for in a poem?
Well, I like poems that are, I don't know, I guess it surprised me in some way. Not poems that set out to be kind of deliberately surprising, but that use language in an unexpected way. I like poems that are moving. It's very hard to sort of define that kind of mysterious quality, but something with a bit of edge, I guess, and mystery. And I just sort of wait for the poem to introduce itself to me. And if the introduction is it kind of takes me in a direction I wasn't expecting, then that's always a good thing.
You're the editor of Poetry Review.
I've literally just started the job, but I've been obviously reading the magazine for many years, and I think it's, yeah, a really great publication and a great place to kind of start if you're looking to delve into poetry magazines. And we do have some audio content online, so there are podcasts where people read poems and are interviewed, and I'm hoping to kind of develop that aspect of the magazine so there's more stuff for people who maybe aren't able to access the kind of printed aspect of the magazine.
Thanks to Leanne and Emily. The results of both the poetry and the short story categories of the RNIB Creative Writing Competition will be announced in the May edition of Connect magazine. And you'll be able to hear the winning entries in full right here on Read On Air.
This is an RNIB talking book.
Why should I not publish my diary?
The Diary of a Nobody by George Ann Whedon Grossmith.
I've often seen reminiscences of people I've never even heard of. And I fail to see, because I do not happen to be a somebody, why my diary should not be interesting.
Mr. Pooter is a man of modest ambitions, content with his ordinary life, yet he always seems to be troubled by disagreeable tradesmen, impertinent young office clerks, and wayward friends. Everyone who's anyone is publishing a diary, so why shouldn't he?
April the 27th. Painted the bath red, and was delighted with the result. Sorry to say, Carrie was not.
This classic is on Talking Books every day at 2, with a repeat at 10, or catch up with every aired episode at rnibconnectradio.org.uk.
The Lie Tree by Frances Harding. Her father disappeared into the throat of the caves, carrying the pot as tenderly as if it were a wounded child. The light receded with him, leaving Faith in darkness. The cave smelt of the sea, but it was not a cheerful seaside smell. It reeked, as if the sea were something old and evil. This sea licked the flesh off shipwrecks, leaving the bare wooden bones in the lightless deep. Its mermaids were green-skinned and squid-eyed, with long hooked fingers and breath that smelt of old fish. At last Faith's father returned, carrying nothing but the lantern. He loosed the rope and jumped back into the boat without a word.
Even before it won the 2015 Costa Book of the Year Award, people were telling me to read The Lie Tree by Frances Harding. My daughter loved it. My friends told me it was unputdownable, and the critics lavished it with praise. But somehow I always found myself reading something else first, so I never got round to it. Set in the male-dominated world of Victorian amateur scientists, the book tells the story of 14-year-old Faith Sunderley, who accompanies her father to an archaeological dig on the island of Vane. But he is pursued there by scandal. And when he dies under mysterious circumstances, Faith is left fighting to save his reputation. His journal leads her to a strange tree.
She opened it and began to read the words carefully inscribed in her father's precise, elegant hand. A study of the alleged virtues of the mendacity tree. I first heard of the so-called mendacity tree when on a visit to southern China in 1860. My visit proved ill-timed, and as I was travelling through the Yunnan region, I heard rumours of the fresh conflict between British and Chinese forces. Uncertain where I might meet hostility, I sought accommodation in a riverside village and waited for further news. There, by chance, I made the acquaintance of one Mr. Hector Winterbourne, a fellow natural scientist. He was a veteran of many excavations and a fanatical collector, with a passion for monstrosity and oddity of all sorts. Pleased at the chance of an educated conversation with one of my countrymen, I spoke with him for the greater part of the night. He waxed fervent about his latest obsession, a plant he had encountered in an obscure legend 3 years before. This tree was said to resemble a creeper, but to bear citrus-like fruit, possessed of extraordinary properties. The plant thrived in darkness or muted light, and would only flower or bear fruit if it was fed lies. This I dismissed as plainly fantastical, and was surprised when my companion did not share my scepticism. When I asked him how a plant could be fed a lie, he said that the falsehood needed to be whispered to the tree and then circulated widely. The more important the lie, and the larger the number of people prevailed upon to believe it, the larger the fruit. Should anybody consume that fruit, they would be granted knowledge of a most secret sort, and on a matter close to their heart. Faith stared. Was this a fairy tale? Why had her famously rational father written of such a thing? At the same time, her thoughts slid to the shrouded plant pot her father had been so desperate to conceal.
Hoping the lie tree will show her the truth about her father's death, Faith begins to spread lies about the island's unwelcoming inhabitants. This is a page-turner from the first. There's plenty of suspense with half-heard conversations, intrigue, glimpses of clues, and a sense of lurking menace. Like Faith, the reader knows that something is wrong, but not enough to know exactly what it is. As with all good fictional English villages, Vane is full of suspicious locals. But there's nothing cliched about this book. Both its characters and plot are meticulously drawn, and it's full of fascinating detail about Victorian life and beliefs. The action takes place shortly after Darwin published On the Origin of Species, and like many of his contemporaries, Faith's father is struggling to be both a man of science and a man of God. As a young Victorian woman, Faith struggles merely to have her voice heard. She is only too aware that her dream of becoming a natural scientist is viewed as unnatural by the society she lives in.
Every child begins their life in debt to the parents that house, clothe and feed them. A son may some day pay back that debt by cutting a figure in the world and raising the family's fortunes. As a daughter, you never will. You will never serve with honour in the army, or distinguish yourself in the sciences, or make a name for yourself in the church or parliament, or make a decent living in the professions. You will never be anything but a burden and a drain on my purse. Even when you marry, your dowry will gouge a hole in the family coffers. You speak so scornfully of Howard that if you do not marry, some day you will need to court his charity or find yourself without bed and board.
In clumsier hands, these themes could weigh the plot down. But like all good storytellers, Frances Harding uses them to support and flesh out her characters. Because she's a children's author writing for young adults, she has the freedom to blend genres. So The Lie Tree is part crime thriller, part gothic fantasy, and part Victorian melodrama, and as a result, totally gripping. For me, the hallmark of a good book is wanting to turn the pages to find out what happens next, while at the same time never wanting the story to end. The mark of a great book is that it leaves you satisfied when you do finish it. The Lie Tree did just that. Like the teenage hero and the age of discovery she lives in, this book brims with potential and excitement from beginning to end. And because it is so good at presenting complicated ideas in an accessible and entertaining way, I too will be recommending it to adults and teenagers alike. My only minor criticism is that the version I downloaded from Overdrive had a male narrator. In a book with a female protagonist and women's rights at its heart, this seemed odd. That said, it is very well read, and it made little difference to this brilliant book. The Lie Tree is available in various formats from the RNIB library, including TB number 23014. Other books by Frances Harding also available include Cuckoo Song, TB 21758, and for younger readers, why not try Fly By Night, Harding's prize-winning tale of Mosca Mai and her homicidal goose, Saracen, who travel to the city of Mandalon hot on the heels of smooth-talking conman Eponymous Clent. With a plot like that, what's not to like? Do you have a book that you'd like to talk about? Maybe you'd like to share your thoughts about an old favourite or review a new discovery. We'd love to hear from you. Please drop us a line by emailing readonair@rnib.org.uk. Now, as promised, it's back to Mark McCree to share the books of his life.
We spoke yesterday on the telephone about how it was that you came to be working in this field and kind of books that may have inspired you. So in terms of a childhood book that had encouraged you into the field that you find yourself in.
Well, I think it'd have to be Mrs. Pepper Pot, the Mrs. Pepper Pot stories by Alf Prosen. I absolutely loved those growing up. So for those people who don't know, she's a little lady who, at times of great inconvenience, shrinks to become an even smaller lady. She gets herself into all sorts of scrapes, and I absolutely love those stories. Also, she makes her husband massive piles of pancakes and drizzles them with syrup. So I think that was also appealing to me.
There was once an old woman who went to bed at night, as old women usually do, and in the morning she woke up, as old women usually do. But on this particular morning she found herself shrunk to the size of a pepper pot, and old women don't usually do that. The odd thing was, her name really was Mrs. Pepper Pot. "Well, as I'm now the size of a pepper pot, I shall have to make the best of it," she said to herself. For she had no one else to talk to. Her husband was out in the fields, and all her children were grown up and gone away. Now, she happened to have a great deal to do that day. First of all, she had to clean the house. Then there was all the washing, which was lying in soak and waiting to be done. And lastly, she had to make pancakes for supper. "I must get out of bed somehow," she thought. And taking hold of a corner of the eiderdown, she started rolling herself up in it. She rolled and rolled until the eiderdown was like a huge sausage, which fell softly on the floor. Mrs. Pepper Pot crawled out, and she hadn't hurt herself a bit.
And the next title that we usually ask our guests to think about is a title that would be their rainy day book. So when it's a bit kind of cold and drab and you've got nothing else to do apart from curl up with a title, which one would you choose?
I really like John Steinbeck as an author. I think I got into him in my late teens, early 20s, and I really like his books. And Cannery Row in particular is a particular favourite of mine. I mean, that's set in the warmth of California, so I think that would help. But it's just the general warmth of the characters that he portrays. I mean, that as a story doesn't really go anywhere. It's not got the most linear of plots or anything. Nothing too dramatic happens. But just the range of characters that spoken about in the book and the warmth of the relationships. Yeah, I think that makes a really perfect book.
I and my friends thought we'd asked you if we could move in there. We'll keep up the property, he added quickly. Wouldn't let anybody break in or hurt anything. Kids might knock out the windows, you know, Max suggested. Place might burn down if somebody don't keep an eye on it.
Lee tilted his head back and looked into Max's eyes through the half glasses, and Lee's tapping finger slowed its tempo as he thought deeply. In Max's eyes, there was goodwill and good fellowship and a desire to make everyone happy. Why, then, did Lee Chong feel slightly surrounded? Why did his mind pick its way as delicately as a cat through cactus? It had been sweetly done, almost in a spirit of philanthropy. Lee's mind leaped ahead at the possibilities. No, they were probabilities. And his finger, tapping, slowed still further. He saw himself refusing Max's request, and he saw the broken glass from the windows. Then Mac would offer a second time to watch over and preserve Lee's property, and at the second refusal. Lee could smell the smoke, could see the little flames creeping up the walls. Mac and his friends would try to help to put it out. Lee's finger came to a gentle rest on the change mat. He was beaten. He knew that.
And finally, Mark, a book that you've read recently that you would recommend to listeners.
Well, I had this one recommended to me. You know, you get all of those end of year lists that, you know, around the new year, of all the books that people have read in the year and thought were fantastic. There was one that was recommended to me by Anthony Dewar, a title called All the Light We Cannot See. I think it actually won the Pulitzer Prize for fiction back in 2015, but I only got to it a few months ago. It's set in the wartime, and actually when I started reading it, I didn't realise that one of the central characters is blind. It's about a young girl who finds herself caught up in the war in France, and it goes to some dark places in the book, but it's, you know, a really fantastic, really vivid writing, fantastic descriptions of the times, and there's lots of threads of story that kind of get intertwined following her life and the life of a German orphan, a young boy, and their kind of lives running parallel in certain ways. And really interesting book. There's a mysterious diamond involved, baddies in there as well. So yeah, it's a classic story and really well told.
16 paces to the water fountain, 16 back, 42 to the stairwell, 42 back. Marie-Laure draws maps in her head, unreels 100 yards of imaginary twine, and then turns and reels it back in. Botany smells like glue and blotter paper and pressed flowers. Paleontology smells like rock dust, bone dust. Biology smells like formalin and old fruit. It's loaded with heavy, cool jars in which float things she has only had described for her. The pale, coiled ropes of rattlesnakes, the severed hands of gorillas. Entomology smells like mothballs and oil. Offices smell of carbon paper, or cigar smoke, or brandy, or perfume, or all four.
Thanks again to Mark, not least for giving us a chance to play a clip from Mrs. Pepperpot's first omnibus. And if you'd like to share the books of your life, why not drop us a line via the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. So, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to Joanne, Tanya, Mark and Emily, and to everyone who's been in touch about their book groups, the titles you've been enjoying, and ideas for books that I should read. Next week, there's another chance to hear our Blind Authors special. Meanwhile, if you've got any suggestions for titles you think we should include in future, or want to get in touch about anything you've heard or read, I'm just an email away. Until then, thanks for listening, and remember to read on.